So now it is truly my pleasure to introduce our speaker this morning, Dr. Katherine Sanderson, who is going to present on the science of success. Dr. Sanderson is the Manuel Family Professor of Life Sciences at Amherst College. She received her bachelor's degree in psychology with a specialization in health and development from Stanford University. She received both a master's and doctoral degrees in psychology from Princeton University. Her research examines how personality and social variables influence health-related behaviors, the development of persuasive messages and interventions to prevent unhealthy behavior, and the predictors of relationship satisfaction. And I will tell you that I had an opportunity to hear Dr. Sanderson present last August, and she is fantastic. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Sanderson to the stage.
Thank you for that lovely intro. My son Andrew was in public school from kindergarten until eighth grade. And in ninth grade, he moved to an elite prep school that he was woefully underprepared for. And he struggled mightily in every possible way. But he struggled especially in Spanish. Midway through his first trimester, he had a 50 in Spanish. And this is a school that uses the traditional 1 to 100 grading scale, so a 50 was really not good. So at the end of November, Andrew calls me and says, "Mom, got my grades. Good news about Spanish." And I said, "Oh, thank goodness, because I was so worried, what with the 50. And he goes, "Yes, it's good news." I said, "Great, what'd you get?" He says, "I got a 58. I said, "That is not good news." And he goes, "No, it's 8 points higher than I had." And I said, "Yeah, but it's an F. You know, that's an F." And he said, "Mom, it's really an F plus." And so, of course, there is no F plus. As I pointed out, I'm a professor. That's not one of our options. So my husband and I go in. We meet with his guidance counselor, Andrew, the guidance counselor, me, my husband. And we're basically like, "Andrew, you got to drop the Spanish. You know, they're going to toss you from the school." And he says, "No, but I love Spanish." And I said, "But you suck at it." And he said, "No, but I love talking and the kids and the teacher. And, you know, I just really want to try." And, you know, the guidance counselor was like, "No." And my husband's like, "No, no." But we agree to give him a month. And he gets a tutor. He agrees to meet with the Spanish teacher every week. And by the end of that month, he'd actually pulled up his grade. He stayed in Spanish. And at the end of his freshman year, he had an A- in Spanish. So his teacher called me and said, "In all of my years of teaching, this is the biggest improvement I've ever seen in any student." And I said, "Is there a prize associated with that?" Which it turns out there's not. But anyway, I start with that story to illustrate what I'm going to be talking about today. That this talk is technically called The Science of Success. But what I'm going to be talking about today is that the science of success is very much about the science of how you respond to failure. And Andrew is a vivid example of experiencing absolute F-plus failure, but turning that into a success. And that's really the fundamental theme of my talk today. So I want to start by talking about emotional intelligence, because the reality is people who are high in emotional intelligence are particularly good at taking obstacles, failures, stumbling blocks, and being able to make something good of them. When we talk about emotional intelligence, it describes an awareness that emotions can drive our behavior and impact us in both positive and negative ways. And it's coupled with an ability to manage emotions, our own emotions, the emotions of people around us, and that's especially important during times of pressure. A high EQ is associated with lots of beneficial outcomes. So people who are high in EQ have better physical health. They have better relationship satisfaction with their personal relationships, their professional relationships. They have greater overall happiness in life. But in terms of what I'm going to be focusing on today, they also have better career success. They have more success in terms of achieving as leaders, starting businesses, and so on. A study a few years ago was done with a really elite group of leaders. These were men who graduated from Harvard Business School. So again, highly elite select group. But they took these men and they examined who among this very select group achieved the highest levels. And they took into account their IQ, their EQ, and a variety of other factors that might predict success. And here's what they found. To be sure, intellect was a driver of outstanding performance. Cognitive skills, such as big picture thinking and long-term vision, were particularly important. But when I calculated the ratio of technical skills, IQ, and emotional intelligence as ingredients of excellent performance, emotional intelligence proved to be twice as important as the others for jobs at all levels. If your emotional abilities aren't in hand, if you don't have self-awareness, if you're not able to manage your distressing emotions, if you can't have empathy and effective relationships, then no matter how smart you are, you're not going to get very far. And this is really the essential aspect of emotional intelligence. It's not saying that some baseline knowledge in IQ isn't important, but what it's saying is that above and beyond that baseline IQ and intelligence, what you really need is this component of EQ to achieve at the highest levels. And let me just ask a simple question. Who here knows someone who's very high in sort of traditional IQ intelligence measures, but seems to lack some sort of basic common sense and ability to relate to people around them? Raise your hand if you, no, don't point at the person. That's just rude. Yeah. So many of us can imagine, again, people that we know who have that constellation of skills. So let's talk about what EQ means. And EQ has five distinct components. One, self-awareness. People who are high in EQ are self-aware. They are self-confident, so they feel good about themselves, but they also have realistic self-awareness. And that means they have a sense of what they're good at, but they also have a sense of what they're not good at. They have a sense of their weaknesses. And that is extraordinarily important because having a sense of your weaknesses lets you do two things. One, lets you work on those weaknesses. What are the things I need to get stronger on? But two, it also lets you hire slash manage teams slash put together groups of people because you have a sense of what I'm not good at. I need to get someone on this team. I need to collaborate with somebody who brings that level of skill. So having this realistic self-awareness is important. And here's the challenge. We all like to be aware of what we're good at. It's actually kind of hard to recognize what we're not so good at. As this cartoon says, I want greater self-awareness, but can I continue to be unaware of my bad qualities? And no, not in terms of EQ. Last, self-deprecating sense of humor. People who are high in EQ don't take themselves too seriously. They're not egotistical. They're not sort of thinking that they're the only ones who know the right answer. Two, they are also high in something called self-regulation or grit. And this is basically the ability to do long-term perspective taking. The ability to do this sort of self-regulating is extraordinarily important for jobs at all levels. And it was first demonstrated in a really clever study done a number of years ago with little kids called the Marshmallow Study. Raise your hand if you've heard about the Marshmallow Study. All right, so that's close to half the room, which is great. So I'll talk about it briefly. Very clever study. It was done at Stanford University in the early 1970s. What they did was they brought in little kids, three-year-olds, four-year-olds. They put them at a table in front of two marshmallows. And they said, you can eat these marshmallows right now, but if you wait for 15 minutes, I'll bring you an entire bowl of marshmallows. And then the researcher walked out of the room. Of course, they, you know, watched this kid throw a one-way mirror and see what happened. So when the researcher walked out of the room, guess what immediately happens for some kids? Study's over. It's like, you know, 3 seconds, done. Other kids do something remarkable. They look at the ceiling, they look at their fingers, they look at their feet, sometimes they turn around, they do whatever they can to not look at the marshmallows, they wait, and in fact, the researcher brings them this entire bowl. So that in and of itself is somewhat interesting. You see this huge range in terms of what kids do, but here's what's even more important. These studies were done in the early 1970s. They have followed up these kids every 5 years since then. And what they found is that the kids who didn't eat the marshmallow in that moment experienced like 800 beneficial outcomes. They do better in high school. They're more likely to go to college. They have higher SAT scores. They're less likely to have credit card debt. They're less likely to get divorced. All of these major sorts of outcomes suggest that this ability to focus on what's the big picture, what's the long-term perspective, and delay the immediate gratification seems to predict lots of positive life outcomes forever, basically. And what is a weird quirk of fate? My husband is one of the marshmallow kids. People always ask me, what did he do? Of course, you know, he doesn't remember what we had to eat last week. There's no chance he remembers what he did when he was three. But he watches a lot of SportsCenter, so that doesn't bode well, right? Anyway. But as Angela Duckworth said, grit is sticking with your future day in, day out, not just for the week, not just for the month, but for years, and working really hard to make that future a reality. Three, internal, not external motivation. People who are high in emotional intelligence are motivated by what drives them at an internal level. But here's the challenge. In our society, external rewards are everywhere. And sometimes the presence of these external rewards decreases what should be intrinsically motivating. Researchers with college athletes have examined enjoyment, love of the game, for athletes who are on different kinds of scholarships. Athletic scholarships, where your ability to stay in school is coupled with your willingness to play the sport, versus need scholarships, merit scholarships, academic scholarships. What you see is that athletes who tie, I have to keep playing this game, extrinsic motivation, show lower levels of enjoyment of their sport. So athletic scholarship athletes report lower love of the game than athletes on any other kind of scholarship or not on scholarship. So the hazard is, sometimes the presence of these salient external rewards decreases people's intrinsic interest in something. As Stephen Covey says, motivation is a fire from within. If someone else tries to light that fire under you, chances are it will burn very briefly. It needs to be intrinsically driven. Four, empathy. People who are high in EQ are very good at perspective taking, putting themselves in somebody else's shoes. This allows them to work more effectively with people around them. As Barbara Kingsolver says, empathy is really the opposite of spiritual meanness. It's the capacity to understand that every war is both won and lost, and that someone else's pain is as meaningful as your own. There is a tremendous range in terms of people's ability to empathize. And I want to tell you about a really classic slash slightly disturbing study that illustrated this. They brought in college students and they said, this is a study on experiencing difficult tasks. And you're going to work with a partner. One of you is going to experience a bunch of difficult tasks. And the other person is going to record their reaction. There's going to be the experiencer. There's going to be the recorder. Then they described the tasks. And the tasks were all like horrible. So one of the tasks was literally you will let a tarantula crawl up your arm. One of them was you will put your hand in a bucket of snakes. One of them is you will hold a rat. So they were all unpleasant. So you draw straws, and of course it's a psychology study, so they rigged it that you pull out the straw, the name, and you get to be the recorder. So you're thinking what? Yes! Thank goodness. Then there's a switch. The researcher comes to you and says, hey, as it turns out, your partner is really freaking out. They are really afraid of spiders. They're really freaking out about having to do this these tasks. And the way this experiment is set up, one person has to experience all the tasks, and the other person has to record all the tasks. So I'm just wondering, would you be willing to switch? Okay, so here's the situation. This is not your friend, your roommate, your sister. This is a random person you're never going to see again. And so some people, when they're told, will you switch, some people say what? No, I'm really pretty good at recording. I think I'll kind of stick with that job, you know. And other people say, okay, I'll switch. Now, here's the good news. There are no snakes, spiders, rats, etc. As soon as you say, yes, I'll switch, or no, I won't, the experiment ends. So you don't actually have to do anything. But what's remarkable about that study is that some people will actually make this switch for a stranger. Now, here's what we all have to worry about. Who has heard about the rising epidemic of narcissism in society? Who's heard about it? They've done studies of college students every decade, And every time they do the study, narcissism rates have risen higher and higher and higher. And narcissism, of course, is the opposite of empathy. It's thinking about yourself, not thinking about other people. This cartoon says, studies show that society is becoming more narcissistic. The other person says, interesting, but how does that impact me? And that's really the challenge that I think we're all facing with this rise in narcissism. Empathy and slash EQ is probably getting lower. Last piece, social skills. People who are high in EQ are very good at working on teams and making sure that everybody's voice is heard and making sure that everybody is acknowledged and affirmed. And this is an essential aspect of getting the best work out of teams and colleagues, is making sure everybody feels validated. Research has shown that when people feel ignored or ostracized, they actually withdraw effort, even if it hurts their own outcome. In a really simple demonstration of this, researchers brought in people and they told them, you're going to be working in groups of three on a brainstorming task in which you have to write about different creative things you could do with a bunch of objects. Teams that create the most creative uses for these objects will win money as they compete against other teams. So everybody had an incentive to do well. So you walk into the study. Your two partners are always sitting there. As it turns out, they're friends of the experiment, or they're not actually part of the study the same way you are, but you don't know that. So you walk into this room. The two people are sitting there, and the three of you sit down. And the researcher says, I'm really sorry. There was a long line at the copier. I haven't finished copying the forms that you need to do this study. It's going to be about 10 minutes. I'm really sorry. But it's really important that for the next 10 minutes, you sit in this room and you don't say anything to each other, because part of this study is about how seeing how people get to know each other when they're working on a group, and that's an essential aspect. So you need to sit here for the next 10 minutes, not talk to anybody. So the three people are sitting there, and all of a sudden, one of the people, who's friends of the experimenter, takes up the ball of the piece of paper on the table, crumbles it up into a little tiny ball, and starts a ball-throwing task. So the three people are all just, you know, fun, throwing the ball around to the different people, et cetera, and they're all going all different directions. They do that for 2 minutes. After 2 minutes of all three people participating in the ball throwing task, the two people who are friends of the experimenter only throw the ball back and forth to the other person, and they totally ignore the third person. And if you watch a video of this happening, the third person is basically like, what the hell happened? Like, it was all so nice, and now it's not. And they're, you know, jumping up. They're trying to intercept the ball. They're trying to make eye contact, and the two people will not look at them and will not throw the ball to them. 8 minutes. And the researcher comes in and says, here are the papers, and here are these different objects. Let's see how your group does at brainstorming. So here's my question. Guess how many ideas the person comes up with who's just been ostracized for 8 minutes. Guess. None. They're like, screw you. I hate you all. Even if it hurts my own outcome because my team could win money, I'm not doing anything. And that's the challenge, that people who don't feel included, accepted as part of a group, they withdraw effort even if it hurts their own outcome. And that's why people with high EQ do, in fact, much better in terms of working in groups. So what are the components of EQ? And I'm giving you a little taste of different items because of the scope of today's time. If anybody wants the entire EQ scale, shoot me an email. I can send it out to you. So, one, some of the major events of my life have led me to reevaluate what is important and not important. People who are high in EQ have a very good sense of priorities. They've often been through some adversity and have this ability to do this perspective taking. It's why they don't take things too seriously. Two, I can tell how other people are feeling just by looking at them. They're very good at sort of nonverbal communication, judging people's facial expressions, body language, etc. Three, seek out activities that make me happy. They structure their lives in ways that bring them happiness. And that happiness extends to how they are in their interpersonal relationships, at work, and in their personal lives. Four, I'm aware of my emotions as I experience them. They have a sense of what they're feeling. And this one seems very obvious, but the reality is lots of emotions at the core can feel sort of similar. Am I really feeling sad, or am I really feeling angry, or am I really feeling anxious? They have a good sense of those distinct feelings, even when the emotion just kind of generally feels bad, they're able to identify what's really the root of that feeling. Five, I'm aware of the nonverbal messages I send to others. So two was about, can you tell what other people are feeling? Five is about, are you aware of what you give off to other people? I gave this talk about a year ago in Charlotte, North Carolina, and a woman came up at the end and she goes, you know, that one for me is so important, that five, because I've been told by so many people that I have resting bitch face. Who's heard about resting bitch face? Probably the women, at least. Anyway, and I was like, yes, that is a perfect example. And she said, I had no idea, but, you know, I look like this, and I'm really feeling happy. But now that I know, I make a point of not doing that. And that's exactly right in terms of what you do to present yourself. Six, I compliment others when they have done something well. So people who are in high EQ are not about just taking all the credit for themselves. They're good at sharing that credit with people around them. So here are the six components, but this is perhaps the most important thing I'm going to say. Emotional intelligence can change. And if it couldn't, really it'd be a waste. You just kind of hear me and be like, here's where you are. Oh, well. But the key is that no matter where you are, emotional intelligence can change. How does it change? Having an awareness of where you're strong and where you're weak in EQ. And all of us have aspects of EQ that we're stronger in, aspects of EQ that we're not as strong in. So having that self-awareness is an essential aspect. And the other thing is having an understanding of your mindset. And when we talk about mindset in psychology, it's the beliefs that you hold about yourself and the world. And this mindset is an essential aspect of changing and improving your EQ, and I'm going to turn to talk about that next. So the mindset is the view you adopt about yourself and the world, and there are two different approaches that people can bring to bear in terms of this mindset. So one, some people have a fixed mindset, and a fixed mindset means you believe that your basic qualities, the qualities of other people, their intelligence, their personality, their, you know, musical ability, their altruism, whatever, are innate and unchanging. So whatever you are, that's where you are. It's stable, it's fixed, it doesn't change. But I'm going to push everybody to adopt a growth mindset. And the growth mindset concept is about believing that your basic qualities can be developed, can be changed through effort and hard work. And this growth mindset is associated with tremendous benefits in terms of the ability to change and adapt and grow across multiple dimensions. I want to give you some real-world examples of how mindset matters. And again, as you're thinking about these, think about how they connect to experiences you've had or can imagine seeing in the world. So who here has heard the stereotype, older people are feeble and absent-minded? Who's heard this stereotype? This is everywhere in our culture. It's not true in all cultures, but it's everywhere in our culture. But here's the challenge. That stereotype and having that mindset about aging is associated with lots of negative outcomes in terms of our own behavior and how we interpret other people's behavior. In a really simple demonstration of this, researchers at NYU brought in college students and they completed a computer task. Unbeknownst to the students, while they were completing the computer task, words flashed up at a subliminal level, so below the level of consciousness. Half the people saw just neutral random words. The other half of people saw words that specifically cued old age. So it was like Florida, arthritis, early bird dinner, shuffleboard, you know, whatever. So again, below the level of consciousness. Then the researcher said, thank you so much for coming in. You know, really appreciate it. Study's over. And the person thought the study was over. But instead, what happened is as soon as the person walked out of the room, the researcher pressed the stopwatch and they counted, timed, how long it took the student to walk to the elevator at the end of the hallway. And what they found is that students who'd just been primed with old age words walked slower. Now, it wasn't like a massive effect. They weren't like, you know, hobbling or, you know, whatever. But the issue is that that subliminal processing actually changed students' walking speed. So this influences people's own behavior. It also influences how we interpret behavior. A few years ago, I was scheduled to give a talk in New Jersey. I live in Massachusetts, and the talk was about a 4-hour drive from my house. Talk was Friday morning at 9 a.m. I'd had a very busy day on Thursday, you know, meetings, teaching, whatever. I, you know, went home, packed, you know, ate a quick dinner with my family, and I finally got in the car at 9 p.m. So that was later than I should have left, but that's when I left, 9 p.m. And because I was leaving so late, I was just going to go and crash at the hotel, so I was wearing sweatpants and a ratty t-shirt and running shoes. So it's like 11 o'clock. I'm on the Tappan Zee Bridge for people who are from the Northeast. It's about 2 hours from my house, 2 hours to New Jersey. And my husband calls, and he says, "Do you know your suitcase is on the bed?" And I said, "No, I did not know that." And I said, "Could you please call and figure out what is open before 8 a.m. in Princeton?" And he goes, "Yes, I'm right on that." So he calls back in like 10 minutes, and he has an answer. Guess what the answer is? There's one thing. Walmart. Some people muttered it. Yeah. Not Target. Don't get optimistic. Walmart. So I check in the hotel. I get a wake-up call for 6 a.m. At 6 a.m., I drive in my sweatpants and ready t-shirt to the local Walmart where I buy a complete outfit. It's not what I'm wearing today. From the Miley Cyrus collection, as it turns out. So I go, I give the talk, and at lunch, I confess to people, like, sort of how hideous my morning had been. And they were like, "Ah, ha, ha, that's so funny, you know, absent-minded professor, blah, blah, blah." But here's the reality. And that happened when I was, like, 40. If I had been 60 or 70, people would have been like, "It's dementia." Yeah, it's really, just losing her mind. It's really setting in. And that's the challenge. Another example. Who here has heard the stereotype of some people aren't good at math? Who's heard about that? Guess what happens if you believe you're not good at math? You stop doing math. Why should I try? I'm not good at math. Why should I keep going? And in fact, you then get really bad at math because it's weird that if you don't try with math, you actually don't learn the math. So as soon as people have this belief, I'm not good at it, they withdraw effort, and that has all sorts of consequences. Third, and perhaps most important, the power of placebos very much is a vivid example that we've all heard about in terms of the power of mindset. So we've all heard about this in daily life, from the power of, you know, placebo to, you know, cure a headache or whatever. But here's what's astonishing. You can even get placebo effects for something as major as surgery. In a study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, researchers at a Veterans Administration hospital in Houston randomly assigned men who needed orthoscopic knee surgery to one of three conditions. One set of men had actual orthoscopic knee surgery. One set of men, they cut the knee open, they scraped the cartilage, they sewed it back up. Third set of men, they cut the knee open, they sewed the knee back up, created a scar, and that's it. Then they followed these men for 18 months, and they asked them about pain, about mobility, can you go upstairs, how's walking, you know, et cetera. And here's what they found. Nothing. All three groups of men showed equivalent levels of improvement as far as 18 months out. All three groups of men improved at the same rate. Now, this is not to say that all surgery is fake and no one should ever have surgery and it's all in your mind. But what it suggests is that believing I've had pain in my knee, it hurts, all of a sudden I'm going to feel better. Maybe those men then followed physical therapy instructions. Maybe they did other things to try to increase their function. Maybe they paid more attention to what the doctors had recommended for rehabilitation, and all of those things impacted their recovery and specifically pain mobility. So mindset matters in major ways. And here's one of the challenges. In our society, we overwhelmingly have a very, very negative view about stress. Stress is hazardous, stress is dangerous, stress is bad for you. And the challenge is that mindset about stress, which is kind of all around us, can actually have unintended consequences. So here's a classic example of something that we hear about very much in society. The effects of stress are negative and should be avoided. Here's an alternative. Experiencing stress facilitates my learning and growth. I do my best work when I'm sort of pushed, I'm learning new things, I'm challenged. Experiencing stress depletes my health and vitality. This is terrible. Here's a flip. Experiencing stress enhances my performance and productivity. I feel active, I feel energized, I feel alive. And the challenge is that if we can shift our mindset, how we think about stress, we can experience all sorts of beneficial outcomes. And this is up to us. We can't avoid stress, but we can change how we think about stress. And I'm going to describe now the major benefits of doing that. Lots of what we experience as stress is actually in our mind. It's an example of mindset, and we have choices about how we interpret things that happen to us. When I was in, shortly after graduating from college, I was dating this guy who was living in Atlanta. We had plans on a lovely weekend to go for a picnic. So we bought a bunch of supplies. We were in his car heading out to the mountains. We were about 10 minutes outside in our drive on this major freeway when all of a sudden his car got a flat tire. This was a number of years ago. There were no cell phones. So his car gets a flat tire. He turns to the side of the road, and I am in the passenger side freaking out. This is going to be really expensive. I'm going to have to stay alone with the car. We're going to have to get the car towed. Our whole day is ruined. And I'm literally freaking out. And my boyfriend turns to me, noticing that I'm freaking out, and he goes, "I'm just going to change the tire. It'll be like 10 minutes. And I was like, "What?" And so we get out. He goes to the trunk, takes out the jack. The car goes up. The tire goes off. The tire goes back on. And it was like 10 minutes. So again, I saw this as this terrible example. And he was like, "It's a flat tire. It'll be like 10 minutes. The power of perception. Another example. My son, the Spanish scholar, when he was like in third grade, I went for a parent-teacher conference. I had this lovely teacher. She was like 22. And so I go to this conference, and she says, "I'm so glad to see you because I'm really worried about Andrew. I think he has OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder." So I have a PhD in psychology. Also, I live with Andrew. And at this time, it's like 50-50 if he's flushed the toilet. His room looks like a bomb hit it. He never uses a hamper. And when she says that, I'm basically like, don't get my hopes up. So I'm like, "Well, why do you think he has OCD? And she says, "I'll tell you. Every day throughout the day, he stands up, he walks across the room to the pencil sharpener, and he sharpens his pencil. And he does this throughout the entire day, repeatedly, like he can't function unless his pencil has a very distinct point on it." So I go home, and I'm like, "Andrew, what the hell are you doing with the pencil sharpener?" And guess what he's doing? Guess what he's doing? He's bored. He's totally bored. So he's figured out, he's like an 8-year-old boy, he's figured out a socially acceptable way that he can stand up and walk to the pencil sharpener. It's a way he can move. And so again, she's interpreting it as this very big problem. He's like, "How do I manage to move in this classroom? Oh, I can break my pencil." You know, that's it. So again, the power of perception. How do you think about a situation? Third example. My middle child, Robert, is a total introvert. Like the kind of kid who invites two people to his birthday party. Very introverted. So on the day that he was taking standardized tests, I was really worried about how he was, you know, going to feel that day. Who here has heard about the massive anxiety students have about taking all the standardized testing, right? I mean, it's everywhere. So I was really worried about how he was going to do and, you know, whether he was going to be able to cope with it. So I sat down with him at breakfast and I said, "Listen, you know, they're testing the school. They're not testing you. You know, just take some deep breaths and just try to stay calm. I know it's a stressful day." And he looked up at me and he goes, "Standardized testing day is my favorite day all year." And I was like, "Okay, well, good. And why?" And he said, "Because it's totally quiet. Everybody just sits and fills in the bubbles. And you don't have to work with a partner. You don't have to read aloud." I was like, "Well, you have a good day." So again, I was experiencing this is going to be this terribly stressful day. It's the day he looks forward to all year. It's the power of perception. That all of those are examples about how we can take something and we can interpret it in different ways. And knowing about this has tremendous benefits. In one study, employees of a large international finance institution were randomly assigned to see one of two videos. Half of them saw a video that described what I've described to you. Stress is enhancing. Stress is invigorating. Stress increases productivity, happiness, etc. The others saw the sort of typical video. Stress is debilitating and bad for you, and it should be avoided and has these negative outcomes. And then they followed up with these people over time to see differences as a function of what video you saw. What they found is that people who had seen the stress is enhancing video showed lower symptoms of anxiety and depression and better work performance. So learning about the benefits of stress is enhancing, led to psychological benefits, and led to improved work performance. As Jack Welch said, your career isn't always linear, but what matters is how well you get back on the horse. So the idea